Hi everybody, this is Micha Sifri from Personal Democracy Media, and welcome back to another edition of the Personal Democracy Plus conference calls with movers, shakers, thinkers, doers, and innovators at the intersection of tech and politics. Today we are going to have a conversation with an old friend, Andrew Boyd, someone I've known for many years. For all his good and provocative works, ranging from working on the issue of campaign finance reform many, many years ago, to some of his greater acts of political mischief, for example, Billionaires for Bush or Gore, which was a street theater enterprise that took off in 2000, and many, many other interesting things that he has done. We are going to be focusing our conversation on this new book that Andrew has assembled, a interesting choice of words, which may become clearer as we talk, called Beautiful Trouble, A Toolbox for Revolution. That's the cover, and the image is a sort of a hammer with a megaphone where you would put the head of the hammer. And the subtitle of the book is From the People Who Brought You the Yes Men, Billionaires for Bush, etc. It's actually edited by Andrew Boyd with Dave Oswald Mitchell, and it has dozens of well-known and not-so-well-known contributors. It's designed to be an activist resource, a little bit like, I suppose, the Anarchist Cookbook. And let me just say, It's really a fascinating resource. In many ways, I think the book is less a book and more a wiki, in the sense that you can kind of open it anywhere and read through it in a variety of directions. It's organized by tactics, principles, case studies, theories, every mini chapter, and they're all basically the kinds of things that you could probably read. Was this designed for reading on the toilet, Andrew? It's
like
sort
the
of book that you did. Anyway, it's a fascinating book and about a really interesting subject, which is this flowering of creative tactics that all kinds of activists are using across the political spectrum, not only on the left, though seemingly it seems predominantly on the left, to move messages, galvanize people, hack with the media, hack with the establishment, and so I'm really fascinated by the subject. Andrew, tell us a little bit. First of all, how did this come together? What was the purpose of this book, and who did you write it for? Who do you think of as the audience for it? And welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Micha. Thanks for having me. And thank you for such a lovely sort of intro to the book. I'm glad you find it, all the things that you are finding it. So just pivoting off of what you were saying just a little bit on the calling it the sort of Anarchist Cookbook, one of the taglines, I am a sort of, revolutionary marketer, if you will. So
revolutionary marketer.
Mm-hmm. Or whatever, a mm-hmm. subvertiser, let's say, a subvertiser. We're calling it like the sort of the Anarchist Cookbook for the 21st century, but without the bomb. That's sort of one kind of like shorthand description of it, or the bastard love child of Abby Hoffman and Saul Alinsky or something along those lines. So those are just sort of, since you mentioned the Anarchist Cookbook, I thought I would sort of just chime in with those two sort of little windows into the book. But yeah, it's got an interesting history, I suppose. I mean, I wrote a book, a kind of a creative street theater mostly, handbook, creative direct action and street theater handbook maybe 15 years ago called The Activist Cookbook. That had a focus on economic inequality, which is the issue I was sort of working on at that time. And, of course, it's come roaring back onto the political stage now. And so ever since then, and very quickly after writing that, within 6 months or a year, it was somewhat obsolete because we were constantly inventing, you know, doing new actions and inventing new forms and expanding our toolbox. And so it's taken me for 15 years now or so. I've wanted to write a book that sort of wouldn't become obsolete, if you will, on the same sort of topic. So much, you know, sort of that kind of book on steroids that wouldn't become obsolete. So I've mentioned this to a couple friends, and one friend said, okay, like a year and a half ago, he was like this is a collaborator from Billionaires for Bush, a web developer, an internet 2.0 sort of pioneer, Philip Smith, out of Toronto. And he was like, okay, it's time. It's time to write this book. You've been talking about it enough. It's time to write Activist Cookbook 2, and I have someone to work with you on it. And he was a friend of his, was Dave Mitchell, out of Saskatoon in Western Canada, and a editor of all sorts of things, most recently of 6 years doing a monthly environmental political journal called Briar Patch. Anyway, so the three of us, he put two of us together, and game was on. So basically, we wrote it in a year and a half, and we pulled together over 70 organizers and artists from mostly in North America, but actually from across the world. We have contributors from Spain, from Denmark, from England, France, South Africa, and almost from Chile. Anyway, so it's quite a range of talent, and some of the usual suspects like the Yes Men, and Code Pink and the Ruckus Society, and then others that people haven't heard of as much, like Smart Meme, who are thinking about memes and stories in a very strategic way and do a lot of trainings with grassroots organizers, sort of to kind of, you know, sort of inculcate those techniques. So I don't know. Those are some of the players we brought together. It was, I'd say, where the internet most played a role in the book was in the assembly of it, in that we had this very far-flung team, and the book was written in a very modular fashion. So it's 140 different modules, whether they're in four main sections: tactics, theories, case studies, and principles. They're all self-explanatory pretty much, except for maybe principles, which is, you can think of as like veteran organizers have these, or artists have sort of operating principles that kind of rules of thumb that guide their practice, and often don't even know what they are, or haven't, like, you know, made them explicit to themselves. And so it was a very interesting process of sort of excavating that and having people, you know, write short little pieces about each of these things. So each module is like an idea-sized or tactic-sized, or, you know, the size of one insight or one idea. And so, as you say, you can read it on the toilet. Anyway, but what's interesting about the structure is that they all intersect.
I think that'll be my blurb, by the way. Yeah.
You can have a good read while having a good shit. There you go. So yes, they're these bite-sized pieces, but there's a depth in that they, in the same way that the internet is sort of superficial but has a depth because everything sort of creates this web of relationships. And so the pieces in the book do that. So a case study of, say, you know, a case study would be also a particular example of a tactic, which would, you know, reference that tactic. But then it would also implement a number of sort of best practices, which would be the principles, and it might be informed by a theory. So everything sort of is woven together.
Right. And I actually, you know, I mean, we could take this conversation in a couple of directions, but it is worth staying on that for one more second. How do you – I mean, I'm looking at, for example, the pages on memes, okay? So memes fall under theory. You know, there's a short description, how do ideas spread, how does cultural change happen, how does a symbol become a shared point of connection for a movement. And, you know, there's a very short description, but what's so interesting about, you know, each of these little modules, as you put it, is – all the stuff on the side. You've got links. I think of this as links. I'm reading a print book, but in the right-hand column I see tactics that this relates to, media jacking, prefigurative intervention, flash mobs, principles like reframing, knowing your cultural terrain. Each of these things have their own section in the book. Theory, case studies, examples of memes, the 99% bat signal, billionaires for Bush, obviously, Occupy Wall Street. And then all of those, in a funny way, the book is not linear. It doesn't seem to me that it's meant to be read in a linear way. And that has, one great virtue, which is, you can dip in and out and sort of follow it the way you might read an article on Wikipedia and then just follow interesting links wherever you want to go.
That's right.
Did this
choose
drive
your own
you crazy?
Adventure.
Just figuring out how to sort everything, or you just said if anything that someone wanted to add a tag to, you just said, fine, okay, there it goes?
Well, that's a very, yeah. So the process of writing, exactly. So how do you write a nonlinear book? Where do you start? How does it grow? If each piece is supposed to relate to all the other pieces, but, at the beginning, they don't exist yet, right? It's an interesting, mm-hmm. how do you build the floor you're standing on? Especially, so part of it is that we began with a small team, right? Just the three of us, say, and an intern. And our first job, or one of our first jobs, was to write 10 sample pieces, right?
Mm-hmm.
To develop, if you will, the template that each piece would use. And each of these different modules, a case study is going to use a slightly different template than a tactic. And so to sort of mm-hmm. develop, to kind of do proof of concept. So we wrote 10 pieces and sort of grew the template that way and put in the related stuff that we sort of could think of. And then, we tapped another circle of people, maybe some of the more usual suspects, from the Yes Men and Code Pink, or not Code Pink, actually, but from the Yes Men and Ruckus and what have you, and invited them. I had certain ideas of pieces that I thought certain people should write, and then also invited them contribute what they thought would be most, to get excited about the project, understand the project, and contribute what they thought would be most useful.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did it all in Google Docs, which was kind of pushing Google Docs to its, within an inch of its life to a degree. Everyone was invited in. We had these collections within collections and, templates and, who was writing what and what the status of all these things were. But we did it all in Google Docs. We could track progress from afar. We then sort of tried to kick things up to into a higher level by having getting people together face to face in what are called book sprints.
Mm-hmm.
And folks who are very internet oriented will know that book sprints are code sprints. They came out of code sprints actually, where people get together for a weekend and write a piece of software, and then coders would get together for 5 days and write an entire instruction manual for a piece of software or something like that. And
mm-hmm.
then so we sort of adapted that for these book sprints, and we actually we didn't write an entire book in a weekend, but we took the book to the next level and got everyone interacting face to face and doing some brainstorms and, pairing off and editing each other's stuff. And so we had four of those weekends, and we actually did some pretty fun kind of writing sports type things where we had bar graphs of how many words each person had written and who was going to win, the other people would buy them beers and, tried to create that sort of sense of a shared mission and excitement mm-hmm. and a little friendly competition. But mostly it was, that intensity of people being together for stretches of 8 or 10 hours and just cranking on stuff.
Right.
And so we did four of those. So it was a very interesting process of virtual collaboration, but then also wanting to have that, what you get from face-to-face, real-world
mm-hmm.
collaboration that really adds a sort of a solid,
right.
Adds an emotional.
One last question about the design of the book, and then let's get into the meat of it. And if you get the ebook, if you buy the electronic version of this, are all these different sections linked so that, it's easy to hop from one to another, or do you have to sort of look up the page number and then go to the other page?
No. So, right, exactly. In the book, in the physical book, there's a page number, so you flip to that page. In the ebook, there's just a direct link, no page number, and you can sort of then just, choose your own adventure, sort of link through the book. And then there's these outside links, under the sort of further insight category, and those take you outside the book to the web at large. So the ebook is very, sort of conducive to this. And then we're also, and we should have it up in about a week and a half, of a website, beautifultrouble.org. There's a placeholder website there where you can read about the book. But in about a week and a half, we'll have the entire book content online and even more seamlessly sort of, you know, using the architecture of the web and the interlinked nature of it than the ebook itself. And all the content will be there. And then we will easily, you know, the idea is that, because where I was saying before, the first time we did this 15 years ago, the book became obsolete within 6 months. Well, this book will not become obsolete because it will evolve alongside the social movements that it tracks and serves, because we can keep adding modules and they can keep getting sort of integrated into the taxonomy, if you will, that we've already established now that we've sort of done that. And that's the idea. The book will always be incomplete and it'll always be evolving. And it's not like totally wide open 2.0. Anyone can upload anything at all, but there's a very strong sort of join the project, you know, invitation, but that it'll still be heavily curated. It'll still be heavily curated. But we hope to expand the community of people writing and tracking this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little bit,
So if the book has an argument about the value of a certain kind of activism, how would you summarize it? Right? I mean, what's the 1 minute summary of what Beautiful Trouble is about?
You know, if you're going to make trouble, okay. I don't know. There's a bunch of things. Let me give it a shot. If you're going to make trouble, make it beautiful. And by beautiful, we don't really only mean some kind of, you know, window dressing, right? A folk song at an otherwise boring labor rally, right? Or an aesthetic protest at a poorly structured, direct action, right? Like it's about it's the aesthetics are central to the design of the action, of the intervention, of the mobilization. And it's not just sort of beauty in the aesthetic sense, but you know, it's the beautiful is a stand-in for make it ethical, make it democratic, make it smart, you know, make it very human, if you will, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, don't get trapped in kind of I'm on 3 hours of sleep, so I've got a few phrases are eluding me, but inside, you know, what's it called? Your inside political game. You know, make it understand the language that people are. Make it about kitchen table economics. You know, make it in the popular vernacular. Understand and use pop culture and how the audience that you're trying to move thinks and feels about it, and make it appealing in that way. You know, don't hit people over the head. Beguile them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's not the best summary I could have given, but it gives you a little flavor of it.
Right.
And that, yeah. And it's like, how do
a
you...
lot of the book, and let me see if I can help you out here, since you only have 3 hours of sleep. A lot of the book seems to me to be about street activism that's designed to capture mass media attention. I'm not sure if that's completely true for every single tactic described in Beautiful Trouble, but a great deal of it seems to operate from the assumption of we live in a mass media age, and we, the, you know, whoever are the actors in the, you know, using these tools, are in terms of ability to reach people through mass media. We don't have money, so we have to be creative about our our tactics to sort of use the mass media to spread our message for us. And then a lot of this is savvy examples of things that people have done to, whether they're pranks like the Yes Men or, more conventional sorts of tactics that people have used to get the message into the media. Right. I mean, is it fair to say this is mostly a manual for people who are looking to kind of crack the mass media, or is there, are there other elements here that are about social media, you know, people-to-people, face-to-face kinds of behavior?
Yeah, I'd say because it's, I guess because of the set of authors that we relied on, and the, you know, that we're trying to bring a savvy understanding of sort of culture and how it can be a game changer in a sort of political struggle, and how, you know, that there's a focus on the mass media, I suppose. But it's less, yes, it's not that, to be honest, and for your audience, it's not super tech oriented. It doesn't it doesn't focus a lot on social media, not because it's certainly a very powerful tool, but there is a bias towards towards direct action and towards the aesthetics of protest, if you will. But it's not just about capturing mass media attention. It's about, you know, winning and whatever that would require. And there's a lot about the dynamics of power when you're challenging a target or trying to put them on the defensive or maneuver them into, you know, a situation where they have, for example, there's a concept called a decision dilemma that's sort of woven throughout the book. And if you're going to engage in a direct action, you have to, often to succeed, you need to, you know, understand the dynamics of power that you're entering into. And what you want to do is force your target into a situation, it's called a decision dilemma, where they have to make a decision, right? So think of George Bush when Cindy Sheehan camped outside, you know, his, you know, his Texas vacation estate at the height of the Iraq War, and demanded to know why her, you know, for what noble cause, you know, quoting George Bush himself, right, just having described the Iraq War as a noble prize, a noble cause, for what noble cause did my son die? Come out of your vacation estate and tell me to my face, right? So that was the sort of challenge. That was her, her sort of throwing down the gauntlet. And that put Bush in a tricky situation. He had two choices. He could ignore her, or he could come out and answer that question. She had an extraordinary, you know, personal power and moral force, partly her personality, but just partly by the nature of the geometry of the challenge that she laid down. And so he did not. He had to make a decision. He would either ignore her or answer her question face to face. But neither of those were going to work for him. And so the longer he strung it out, the longer his vacation lasted and he sort of stayed there, and the more attention that she got and the more people showed up and the bigger this sort of encampment got and the bigger the profile became in the media, the more he was in a pickle. So there's so yes, there's a media dimension to it, but there's also fundamentally a sort of the logic of direct action, if you will. And another important concept that goes along with this is what we call action logic. And that you want to design your action, and this can be for the media or for, you know, the local community. You want to design your action so it explains itself, so it's legible and readable by, you know, immediately, just upon sort of looking at it. So her action was very much along those lines. It didn't require, you know, much in the way of explanation. You know, think of the lunch counter sit-ins in the early 60s. They explained themselves. There you were with, like, you know, in some of these classic photographs, one of which we have in the book, you know, four mixed-race students sitting in a lunch counter and being, you know, having the crowd gathered around them and, you know, dumping milk and sugar and salt and, you know, junk all over them, and them sort of maintaining an extraordinary level of discipline and dignity, but basically bringing into being in that one place for that one moment in a prefigurative way the society they wanted to live in themselves. They had integrated a lunch counter in a sort of immediate direct action kind of way that not only, in a sense, created the world they wanted to live in that moment, but also telegraphed the possibility of the whole society moving in that direction, and painted themselves in this sympathetic light by, you know, being dignified and disciplined, and showed, sort of brought out the made the racism of that was holding back these changes very visible in the theme.
Sure.
So it was there was a whole mess of different principles from the book in that in that one example. There's the idea of a prefigurative action that sort of enacts the world that you want to bring into being. There's the sort of action logic that the action is immediately readable just by seeing a photograph of it, or being a sympathetic person in the Woolworths itself. There's the idea of the real action is the reaction, that beyond your actual action, the story that kind of might explode forth from that is the reaction of the other player. In this case, the angry mob that tells what's wrong even better than your most articulate statement or act could. And so there's it gets into all of that, which doesn't certainly helps for it to travel through the mass media or social media or any kind of media, but is in a more kind of primary way about power and just psychology and human interaction and the sort of, the logic and dynamics of action in that kind of situation. Anyway, does that
That makes sense.
It's both ands.
Let me pause and just say, if folks listening want to, from this point forward, ask a question or make a comment, just hit *6 on your phone, and I'll pull you into the conversation. But Andrew, what I would love to do with you for the second half of the call is to talk about how the internet, the online arena, changes the dynamics of this kind of action, for better and for worse. You've been doing this kind of work, from before there was an internet, through the period now where, frequently people will deliberately stage an event or try to capture something on video, the purpose being that they know there's a secondary audience online. There's obviously a lot that takes place because something spreads online, because there's certain kinds of images or visceral reports that move people. And this, can work in many different ways. I think you and I can certainly think of examples of successful viral campaigns, and we can also think of others, where simply because somebody, I'm thinking of Andrew Breitbart at the moment, took some sound of somebody talking, edited it to make it seem as if they were endorsing racism when they were actually, denying it, got that into the media. I mean, there's a danger here too, right? That messages spread today, Kony 2012, another good example of this, they can spread quite powerfully. And activists obviously have to be aware of this, not just that there's a new toolbox to use in terms of documenting your own action, pulling a virtual audience in along with you if you can live stream. I mean, there are a variety of these things. But also, you don't know necessarily how this stuff will be used or what kinds of things will go well. You and I spoke last year in trying to understand why Occupy Wall Street was so successful with just the street action, but also the virtual solidarity that it generated, when other efforts like the other 98%, a group you helped start, which had many of the same, we're using many of the same tools, including social media, including well-produced viral video, great messaging, all of the building blocks one would think that made Occupy Wall Street successful, during the months when it was dominating the news. So What does the online environment do for this kind of activism? How does it make it harder, or how does it make it easier? I mean, what are the challenges involved? Take that in any direction you want.
I'll just say some obvious things. I mean, there's a degree to which we are the media that, you know, we weren't back in the days of broadcast, right?
Right.
So, you're able, I'm here at Netroots Nation, and, we just did a panel with, you know, Liz Winstead and Lee Campy on James, and, and it was about sort of how pranks and video can change the political conversation, you know, kind of create breakthrough moments for issues that are important to us. Anyway, and I end up showing the video of this, the public option Annie, which is sort of a good example of the synergy between direct action, you know, self-documentation, viral media, and mass media, because we snuck 11 people into the largest gathering of insurance industry, you know, health insurance industry executives at the height of the health, you know, the epic healthcare battle. We stuck 11 people in. 5 of them were singers. 6 of them were videographers. You know, we were all dressed up like lobbyists, and we serenaded with a very funny, sort of catchy, tiny little song. We serenaded Bill McInter, who was the lead pollster for the health insurance industry, at his keynote speech. So it had that sort of cachet of being in the belly of the beast, right in the face of one of the people most responsible for trying to sort of stop Obama's healthcare initiative. Anyway, and we sang this kind of cute little song, and we captured it on video, and they pushed us out the door, and we cut it super fast, like in about an hour and 15 minutes, we cut it together just in time for the news cycle. You know, we had Fenton Communications working with us there. We put it online, pushed it out, and then Fenton was able to, you know, sort of, we had a video up online, and it was getting some, you know, getting some traction on, it was put up to HuffPost first, but then Fenton Communications sort of pushed it out to the mass media. Rachel Maddow picked it up. Ashton Kutcher tweeted it, right? And he had the largest Twitter following at the time. I think that was back in the days when 350,000 followers was the most anybody had. So it was this sort of synergy of a lot of different elements. And then it went up on Wolf Blitzer. It was running on, you know, Situation Room. And then The Daily Show eventually picked it up, you know, when it blew out Jon Stewart's eardrums, are supposedly bad singing, but it was actually excellent singing. Any case, so that just shows you how you can, you know, whatever. She sung at the Metropolitan Opera for 6 years. You know, the lead singer was very, very well trained. In any case, the point here is that how without the internet, we just wouldn't have been. It wasn't only the internet. It wasn't only social media. If we hadn't done the direct action, we wouldn't have had this sort of this puckish, prankish kind of story to tell. If we hadn't sort of understood that the audience that where we did the prank, right, the 100 or so health insurance industry lobbyists wasn't the real audience, right? That the audience was the mediated audience that we brought in more videographers than we brought in singers, right? And they were all dressed like corporate lobbyists, and we had rehearsed it so that the videographers would be capturing certain either reaction shots or the various soloists who were singing or the you know, whatever. We had it all mapped out, so we knew exactly what cuts we want. So it was this interesting. You wouldn't have done that before the internet, and there was this interplay of all of these elements, and it allowed this thing to sort of, you know, blow up for its moment and add an additional, you know, push to this, you know, it is one little chapter of this epic healthcare fight, but it helped to get the public option to Harry Reid to push the public option onto the Senate agenda later that week, you know? So, you know, and then of course that all went, all went to hell, but that's just an example, I think, of, all of these different and actions that is very aware that it's operating in the internet age, right? And that
right.
in the mediated age. So that's just one example there. But having
you know, literally saturated yourself, embedded yourself in this space now, you know, to do this book. I mean, I think you have you know, I mean, you're in the thick of a lot of these things all the time. And maybe it's not fair for me to ask you on 3 hours sleep to wax philosophical about this, but, you know, not my fault that you only got 3 hours of sleep. First of all, how do you know if these kinds of actions are making a difference? One. Two is, does the ease of, you know, as we like to say, the internet lowers barriers to entry. It's a lot easier for people to launch ideas. And, you know, I have to say, I'm certainly fascinated by how often now you will see surprising, you know, tactics or memes just pop up and take hold, at least temporarily. You know, Mitt Romney is misspelling things, and now there's a website, I'm sure, that's devoted to that, that, you know, people can share with each other, and, you know, there's sort of the digital water cooler on steroids thing. You know, there are lots of tactics that organizations would never, you know, take on their own, but individuals who don't have organizational responsibilities can just do whatever they want. And there's also a lot of really bad, dumb, you know, pointless or worse, counterproductive stuff that people can do, that can alienate others. You know, so does this, you know, the environment that we now have, navigating it in all its complexity, I mean, what is, you know, in your mind, you know, what's a good example of, the best of it is, yeah, you can get your message to millions and millions of people on a, you know, maybe a few $1,000 budget and just a lot of really good, smart, beautiful planning. That's, you know, and social media and the internet absolutely are critical to, you know, moving stuff up the food chain into mass media. But are there ways that it makes this work harder or less relevant?
Mm-hmm.
And there is this critique of clicktivism, right? That, you know, we think we did something because we shared a video. So, you know, how do you respond to that?
Well, there's a lot of, you're throwing a bunch of things at me, and I'm going to handle them all. No.
Okay. And I have a person waiting on hold here who wants to ask a question, so let's make sure we have time for them.
Okay, great. So a couple thoughts. One is, yes, there's a lot of crap out there. Anybody can do anything. It's a fluid environment, right? So two thoughts on that. One is you have to get a certain kind of critical mass, right? To sort of you can definitely, you know, pop your cool new novelty concept, you know up, and then it goes away, but then nothing really happens. So you need a critical mass, or have a big idea that people can sort of, you know, introduce a new frame, or what we call a meme, you know, an idea that a large idea that can sort of take on sort of mutating viral properties, but still maintain its coherence and catch hold of the imagination, or have a campaign that kind of consistently drives something home, right? To make a difference, to change the sort of landscape. And I'll just think of a couple different sort of examples where that works or doesn't work. I mean, one is like, I don't know, this is, you know, the billionaires for Bush, or just, you know, I know it's a bit of an old example, but it's the campaign I've been most involved in, where we kept, you know, it was a year-long campaign. You know, we started, you know, whatever, November of 2003, and we designed it to really just tar Bush the billionaire brush, right? Like, that was sort of the idea. And we used, like, everything at our disposal, every medium, you know, whether it was video or parody, soundtracks, street theater, you know, pranks, everything. But it was all sort of structured, you know, with the overriding goal of inserting this meme into the public mind, getting it picked up by the media, and having it sort of have a viral properties and just tar Bush with the billionaire brush. Thus, the name of the website was Billionaires for Bush. The name of the organization was Billionaires for Bush. All the signage was, you know, was sort of branded very much to keep bringing it back to this message, and the humor and the creativity and all that was merely just a vehicle for doing that. And it was designed in a couple different ways that sort of maybe understood this sort of hostile, fluid, you know, internet-ish environment that we were talking about, and that we designed it defensively. So that, like along the lines that I'm saying, that always there was this thing that was inescapable, which was this sort of concatenation, this sort of building this heuristic between Bush and billionaires. That if you were not a billionaire, you know, there was no good reason to vote for George Bush. That, you know, the billionaires were supporting this guy for a reason, right? So there was like just constantly kind of making that relationship again and again and again, and that even if the mass media sort of things get fragmented out there and they sort of pulled it apart or misrepresented certain things, it was very hard to misrepresent that core kernel idea. So that was one way you sort of defensively program and design your idea. You sort of push it consistently over a period of time at every possible, you know, sort of tool or medium you can, but with one overriding goal. And you have a good meme and a good idea that's really catchy, right? So that those are some of the elements. And then also you design your campaign in a sort of with this tricky balance. And this is sort of where the artistry, if you will, comes in, with this tricky balance of an open architecture for invitation and participation and people taking a hold of it and sort of mutating it and iterating it and adding their particular flair and creativity to it. And that sort of is very, very inviting and adds richness to the overall efforts, and it sort of becomes this organism that's larger than, you know, you put it in motion, but then it takes on a life of its own. But that you also sort of design it so that it maintains its sort of core coherency along the lines that I was talking about before. So that was a way that we were able to sort of, in a sense, sort of let it loose, but also have it do the work that it was designed to do, and that it had a, you know, anyway. So that's one example of sort of how to operate in this fluid, potentially, you know, a lot of noise, and how to maintain your signal in this sort of space in which it kind of
there's
devolves
a lot of noise.
Towards noise, right?
Right.
So that's
invite, we have a caller, it looks like, from New York. Tell us who you are and go ahead, ask your question, make your comment.
Yeah, hello. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be a part of this and to listen. Appreciate your insights. I have a question around the idea of creating collaborative structures without opposition. So a lot of your work that you've spoken about and have done, it's always pushing against something and somebody. And is it possible to actually make inspirational work that we can work across borders to succeed? So I, you know, love what's going on right now with citizen action, but it's hard for me to understand when the occupiers want to talk about the 99%, but they won't talk to the Tea Party, which surely is a part of your 99%. So these kind of questions of how do we actually create coalitions to work together?
Very interesting question. Andrew?
Yeah, Mika, you know, you've had a lot of experience with this.
Let me see if I can add a comment then. And the book actually does a number of things that are interesting. There's one of my favorite chapters is called something like "Nobody Likes Watching a Drum Circle."
Yeah.
Is that the right title?
Yeah, I think so.
And you know what I got from that was
nobody
that
wants to watch
you know
a drum circle. Yeah.
Nobody wants to watch a drum circle, right? And the idea being that you know there are certain things that activists can get caught up in that become very self-reinforcing, but not necessarily reach people outside the charm circle. And I think it's and there are other parts of the book that, that take the, this point on as well, that, that movements inevitably develop an identity, and then that identity, which can be very satisfying for people, can also be very off-putting if the goal is to reach, you know, people who are not yet converted.
Sorry, did I take a
spot? And, you know, Wael Goniem, who wrote a very interesting book about his experiences building part of the movement that helped topple Mubarak in Egypt, specifically makes a distinction between activism and engagism, and because he was interested in engaging the people who were not yet converted. And I think that our caller is sort of raising this question in a similar way, which is, does these kinds of tactics, you know, what about this work reaches across boundaries and helps convert people as opposed to reinforce sort of build up the power of a self-selecting group?
Yeah, I'm thinking in a world where we need coalitions to come around a post-SOFA era, where we have bigger issues that we can't just be bifurcated by party.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Where
have you seen in your work, Andrew, you know, strange bedfellow type things that have worked?
I've seen it. I'm thinking of some examples. It's not necessarily in my work, but I remember very notable to me. It sort of made a real impact on me that Move On and the Christian Coalition back, I think, about somewhere in the 2006-ish era, not sure, collaborated to prevent change in FCC ruling, right? Federal Communications.
Right.
And that they were going to allow a higher, they were going to permit a higher concentration of media held in the one in one by one media entity. And for very different reasons, both sort of the Move On membership and the those sympathetic to the Christian Coalition were very opposed to this, you know. And it was a sort of, it cut in a different, you know, it cut orthogonally to partisan lines. It wasn't about the content of the media, you know, but the Christian Coalition folks wanted to hear their local church radio station or whatever, and the Move On folks wanted, you know, NPR not to be bought up by, you know, Gannett or whatever. But they could both, you know, agree on, you know, in the relative direction of community-controlled media or a more democratic, more diverse media environment. Anyway, so they teamed up against this one very specific thing. So that was one just sort of kind of one shining example. It's not from, you know, necessarily the kind of toolbox we're talking about in the book.
Right.
But...
do you see it necessary? Like, I love the kind of stuff that is, you're presenting. I'm just trying to think of ways for us to really kind of like join together in a more massive movement when the new nation is an online nation. The new party is something that is diverse in language and perspective and culture because I can connect with millions of people online that don't even know what a Republican versus Democrat are. But we may have some very pertinent issues to work out together, and I love your tactics to move forward to help us create some sort of movement, because I don't believe SOPA is the end. I believe that is really the beginning. That is like they're going to keep pushing until they understand that they can regulate something that, as you call, is an open architecture. They cannot regulate that space, but they will try and try, and we have to create coalitions that are beyond party lines.
Well, that's a really good point, Kohler, and I should just say that in fairness to Andrew, it isn't his specialty, that set of issues. We're going to come back to it. We did do a call, I think about 6 or 7 weeks ago, with Patrick Ruffini and David Siegel from the right and the left, respectively, talking about the ways that the anti-SOPA coalition could continue to find common cause around other issues or work you know, in concert. So I don't know if you caught that call. You want to go back? It's in our archives on personaldemocracy.com.
Thank
Andrew,
you. Just what's inspiring about Andrew is that it's.
Oops.
It's fun, right? We need fantasy. What Andrew does helps inspire us because we don't want to just look at the polar bear on the glacier. I don't want the depression and inertia of, you know, these kind of things. And what Andrew does is inspire us to actually participate in another way. So that's why I was asking. Thank you.
Right.
Yeah, no,
great.
It's a fair question. And, you know, in the best, in one, there are many reasons why people from different partisan sectors should, you know, you would hope could respond to the tactics because they're sort of engaged, you know, they're cognizant of you know, basic human things that are beyond politics, right? Whether it's humor
mm-hmm.
or some or what's beautiful or the invitation to participate, you know, these kind of things you would hope could pull in people irrespective of ideology, but you know. They're often tied to, you know, sharply, pretty sharply, to an agenda, and so then you lose people from one side that way. And until you hit the right issue, it's more like it's more about framing the issue. And I think part of this, the 99% was an attempt to an extraordinarily successful meme and frame that makes the point. It's not, you know, blue and red. It's not left and right. It's 99 and one. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean, but you know, but then it had all these sort of hippie aesthetics on the ground, so it was sort of painted with a less than populist brush.
I would also say I've encountered people from within the Occupy movement who are very open to dialogue with anybody, including Tea Party people, and I've also encountered people who absolutely refuse to have that dialogue. And, you know, in some ways this is just a reflection of, you know, where we are right now as a country or as a society.
Yeah.
There's a lot of polarization, and then there's also a lot of blurring of the lines because not everybody, you know, identifies themselves in a particular box all the time anyway. So, which is something that certainly gives me some hope.
Let me bring a concept in, Mika. Let me bring a concept in from the book that speaks to this, because I think it's one of the most interesting concepts in the book, and I didn't know about it in the way it's talked about in the book until, you know, except in the making of the book did I come across it, and it's called a floating signifier. And it sounds like a fancy sort of, you know, postmodern literature kind of thing, and I guess sort of its origins are there. But the idea is a signifier is something, you know, if you will, that represents, right, a kind of symbol, a sign in the simplest sense. And a floating signifier is a signifier that is it's unstable or unclear in its meanings or open to many interpretations, has many valences. And the person who wrote this piece in the book, in the theory section on floating signifier, Matthew Smucker, was, you know, has done all, you know, he's used to work for the War Resisters League, for Move On, and he's now got his own sort of think tank at a place called Beyond the Choir, and he's thinking, I think, exactly along the lines that the caller is interested in, and you might want to check it out, beyondthechoir.com or .org, I'm not sure which, but he would then became very, very involved in Occupy Wall Street once it sort of, you know, got going, and theorized about what it was. And this gets back to your point, Mika, about, you know, why did this one break out? Why did Occupy Wall Street break out when other efforts that had, you know, similar smarts and maybe similar positioning and framing did not? And partly, you know, he felt that this notion of Occupy Wall Street, of people just planting a flag on the steps of, you know, on the threshold of Wall Street, who we all know, you know, threw us into a potentially unnecessary depression and got off scot-free for it and had never been held to account. And finally, some folks were sort of standing up and, you know, making a stand and just and doing it in this sort of powerful, symbolic, theatrical, you know, not, I don't mean theatrical in a false way, but the theater of it was very was very evident and very potent. And but it meant a lot of things to a lot of different things to a lot of people. And
right.
you know, and across it wasn't fixed. It wasn't ideologically fixed, or it hadn't been the, you know, the powers that be hadn't been able to fix it as being about a particular type of person or a particular type of politics. And the fact that they had no demand at the beginning, while in some ways, you know, sort of very squishy and unstrategic, was, whether intentionally or not, was kind of genius, because it left anyone to bring their demands. Everybody has personal demands, or every group has demands, and everyone, you know, felt that Wall Street was at the root of a lot that was wrong, and so it kind of created this incredibly open feeling and symbolic space that people could, you know, could bring their what was in, you know, whether it was their stories, if you remember the 99% blah, you know, Tumblr,
mm-hmm.
they could bring their
mm-hmm.
stories to it, but also could bring their politics, could also bring their specific demands, and a lot of the you know, audit the Fed folks showed up there, but, you know, they didn't get, you know, a sort of attraction in terms of a sort of majority, but whatever, people were there. So anyway, and then what happens is if you can keep that going, then the movement can sort of grow and build, but if it gets sort of fixed in people's minds, if it, you know, gets shut down and then starts to sort of self-marginalize itself, and people then, you end up with this rump group of folks, and they get deep into their own political identity anyway, and then it sort of becomes not a universal symbol, not something that people feel is their own anymore, then
right.
it's harder to but you can build a mass movement around the right floating signifier. So anyway, that's just sort of something that's in the book that at the theoretical level maybe is helpful for thinking about how to have a broader unity that people actually feel in their bones. Hey, Kate.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the Tea Party sort of works in a similar way for it's had the optics of something that people could sort of, it was open and fluid and, you know, had these sort of all American kind of look and feel to it, you know, but it obviously had a very strong right wing critical mass to it. But in any case, Barack Obama was another good floating signifier. He meant so many things to so many different people. We didn't know what it exactly was. And then, you know, then his presidency sort of, it became fixed. And, you know,
right.
he kind of lost that extra sort of measure of support. And anyway, I could keep going on about this, but if you buy the book, look up the floating signifier, and that might be, see if you can put it into action.
I should say that I heartily recommend people do buy the book, Beautiful Treble, or go check out beautifultreble.org. The website for the book, which, as Andrew said, will soon be showcasing a much more elaborate and interactive element to the modules in the book that people will be able to add to. So in many ways, the book itself is a activist project, along with the types of stories it tells and lessons that it teases out for activists of all stripes. Andrew, thank you so much. Sorry, we caught you with a little less sleep than usual amount. but greatly enjoyed talking with you. Enjoy Netroots Nation. Say hello to all
Thank
our
you.
Friends there. And if you go over to Write Online, do the same thing. For folks who have been listening, this is Personal Democracy Media. You've been listening to our PD Plus call with Andrew Boyd. And thank you again, Andrew.
Mika, can I say one? Can I just get one thing in, because it's an important
yeah.
detail? That's a,
yep.
And that's a fantastic set of shows, and I think I would like to tune in. But the book is not available in bookstores right now, and it is not available on Amazon for the next not for another month or two. The way the publisher works is that you have to order it directly from the website. So go to
Beautiful that's right, or books.
Or mm-hmm. books, or we prefer you to go to beautifultrouble.org. You can order the book right there. It's $25 for the hard copy, and well worth it. $8 for the ebook. So that's just want to make that clear, because that's where you get.
Oh, that's
book.
Right. And they're good
book.
Folks. They publish my WikiLeaks book, so go support Or Books. Thank you, Andrew. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you all in a couple of weeks.